Okay, well, so thanks. Thanks to the organizers slash coordinators for asking me to speak. So I thought a bit about what I should talk about, since I was asked to give you each talk on fluid gravity. And some of you already heard some aspects of this from Veronica's colloquium a couple of weeks ago. So I decided to structure it somewhat differently and try to take a slightly different perspective, rather than go through the nitty-gritty details of what we did, what was the construction, and so on. And so let me dive right in and give you two broad motivations that I think lead me to still think about this question. And I should say at the outset that since there are a large number of topics slash papers I will talk about, I decided the simplest thing for me to do is not quote any references in what I'm going to say. So ask me if you need any questions.
Taped and broadcast.
Yes. So I either offend nobody or everybody maximum.
You should repeat every line.
Let me start with a motivation that comes from holography and ADS-HT correspondence. I'll step back from this in a moment. But the one motivation that I'll start with is to understand dynamics of conserved currents in quantum field theories with holographic gates. Now, this is an interesting question in itself, because among the set of conserved currents is the stress tensor. And the stress tensor, via the ADS-HT correspondence, maps to the bulk matrix. So in some sense, you might say that this set of objects, which exists in field theories, is an interesting set of objects to consider if you want to sort of see how field theories can holographically be related to bulk geometries. But let's step back a little bit about this statement. What we know from ADS-CFT is that is a statement that single trace operators in the field theory map to single particle states in the bulk. And I should say from the outset that I will only be discussing the field theories in the plane of limits. I will really at large end. So I have some notion of classical geometry to begin. Now, let me not say that just yet. So this is a statement that's true at the level of the ADS-CFT correspondence, and this in principle could be true even at finite end, that you have single trace operators in the CFT at finite end, and they would map to some single particle states in string theory in the bulk. Right. So we can ask, what does ADS-CFT buy for us? And one thing it buys for us is that the dynamical equations for these single trace operators, so let me call these operators collectively O, the dynamical equations for expectation values of the single trace operators is somehow some kind of string field theory in the bulk. We don't know what that is, but if we restrict to large lambda or large coupling in field theory, then the dynamical equations for these single trace operators simplify to supergravity equations. So we could say, fine, so we could sort of study the dynamics of single trace operators, the dynamical equations in the plane of limit of a class of single trace operators in field theory, and all we need to do to understand that setup is study the dynamics of supergravity theories in some backgrounds. The problem with this, of course, is that there are infinitely many such operators, and so even sort of trying to understand what this set of dynamical equations is is trying to, essentially amounts to trying to classify solutions to all of supergravity equations in 10 dimensions. So, and that's where this statement comes in. We can, if we truncate our attention to restricting to conserved currents, in the field theory, then we can restrict attention to a subclass of states in the bulk, and in particular, if I just restrict attention all the way down to the stress tensor, then the one-point functions of Webb of the stress tensor should be governed purely by dynamics of the bulk metric. Okay, and this is a statement not just of a particular class of particular example in ADS-CFT. This is a statement of ADS-CFT for a wide variety of conformal field theories. So the statement would be the dynamics of T mu nu in a large class of CFTs is governed by dynamics of Einstein equations in an asymptotically ADS D plus 1 case. So I'll talk about d-dimensional CFTs and correspondingly one higher dimensional bulk space. Now this statement, I should say, is something we know from the bulk. And as far as I know, I don't know how to prove this from field theory. I don't know how to derive that restricting attention to purely the stress tensor in the large and large lambda limit reduces to Einstein equation. If you can derive that statement, that would be tantamount to, in some sense, showing how ADS-CFT works. So, so the many chains in coming down here, one chain of the chain of logic involves starting with string theory, restricting to its massless states so that we have supergravity, and further restricting to looking at a consistent truncation of supergravity down to gravity in ADS D plus 1, all of which end up with us focusing on the stress tensor. But at no stage of this argument do I know this argument to have been proved outside in some starting in from first principles from the CFT. Okay. So that's one statement I want to make. And so the focus will be, for the large part of the talk, will be on the dynamics of just the stress tensor. We might, and I will discuss what happens when we add other conserved currents, because we might want to look at other adding more structure. But this statement has some universal features which is not shared when I add other conserved currents. Okay. And what I want to show you is that the fluid gravity correspondence is a statement which amounts to a solution of this dynamical problem in a certain limit, which I will call a long wavelength limit for reasons I'll explain as we go. Okay, so to be sure, understanding the entire dynamics of the boundary stress sensor is tantamount to solving or maybe even classifying all solutions to Einstein's equations with desired boundary conditions. But you can do that in this long wavelength, in a certain sense. So that will be one statement that I'll try to establish. And my objective for today is not sort of give you the sort of details of how this construction works, but along the line, what I want to do is give you a sketch of how this works, and then tell you what we've learned from this, both for what are the implications of this kind of construction for holography on one hand, and also for relativistic fluids, which will be the outcome of this construction on the other. So that's one set of motivations to look at this problem. My second motivation is to establish the following inclusion, which steps back from fluid gravity and holography, that A, the fluid gravity contains what I would naturally call the membrane paradigm in a certain sense, and it's in turn is contained in a construction that has been pioneered by people like Niels Heer and Roberto Emperon called Blackfoot, which sort of takes away the crutch here which we used in this construction of asymptotically ADS spacetimes and embeds this for black holes in arbitrary asymptotic geometry. So the slogan that I'd like to give for this black hole, which I'll explain as we go along, is that if you have black brains in some theory of gravity, then if you have some brain which has some, it's black, so it has some thickness and some extent along the water volume, then black brains behave like fluids along their world volume, and they behave like elastic solids, normal to the world volume. So we heard on Monday about what soft matter is. Here's soft matter in gravity. Okay. And there's a very precise sense, in a very similar spirit to the fluid gravity construction, in which this fluid description along the world volume of this black brain arises in this long wavelength limit. And people call this the intrinsic dynamics, because it's along the world volume. And this elastic solid behavior is said to be the extrinsic dynamics, sent normal to the world volume. And the punchline of the whole story, when you put all these together, is simply that black objects, when you're not simple black objects like Schwarzschild black holes, but black objects which have some hierarchy of scale, you have some world volume, brain-like objects which have some world volumes and transverse directions and so on, they have some collective dynamics, and that collective dynamics in all cases is effectively fluid dynamics. So I'll show where that collective dynamics comes from and how you can see fluid dynamics emerging from the dynamics of black holes. So this fluid dynamics will be inherited from the dynamics of bulk Einstein equations. So it's not something that we input, but it's an output of just a consequence of Einstein equations. Okay, so that's the sort of broad motivation. So let me pause to ask if there are any questions before I tell you a little bit how to make sense of this story.
Okay, since you asked for questions, this last statement I thought was kind of intriguing. I know you're going to tell us the fluid story, something story about the derivative expansion and the long wavelength approximation.
Yes.
The elastic solid part, I don't know what you're going to talk about. That's something that I'm not clear how precise that is. But clearly that's not a story about a derivative expansion. You're talking about behavior on the length scale that sets the relevant scale for the derivative expansion.
That's right.
My question is whether there's room in the story for some stronger statement that maybe the elastic solid behavior is the correct description, not just transverse to the world volume, but also along the world volume at short distance scales that might have, somehow have a crossover behavior to the fluids on long distance scales? In other words, is the relevant, the concrete question would be at the level at which things are known, is the difference between the elastic behavior and fluid behavior clearly, whether it's parallel or transverse, or might it be just a question of what scales the subject is?
It's actually just because the two kind of perturbations decouple if you consider stationarity. So there's no elastic behavior along the world volume directions if you assume the black hole to be stationary. But if you allow for it to be fluctuating simultaneously, then the two perturbations can couple along the world volume directions.
So, I'm not sure.
Okay.
So, and I will not talk about the elastic solid part. But what I can say is that I understand how the fluid dynamics emerges in some collective sense. I don't have a similar understanding for how the elastic solid behavior emerges in the same sense. So there are derivations of this elastic solid behavior, that's certainly true. I mean this in a very particular sense that will become clearer. I'll ask you this. Okay, so given these motivations, I actually want to step back and talk a little bit about relativistic fluid, not just because I like the subject, but because there are some elements of this which I will use later to put constraints on holography toward the end of the talk. Okay? So here's what I think is an autonomous theory of relativistic fluids. And by this I mean, you're given just conservations, you're just given basic data, and I want to construct the dynamics of fluids from this as an IR effective field theory. How am I supposed to do this? So the picture I have in mind is that fluid dynamics is something that's valid when systems achieve local but not global equilibrium. Or better yet, you start with a system that's in global thermal equilibrium and allow small fluctuations that happen on scales much larger than the mean free path or sort of characteristic scale of variation on this fluid are much bigger than the sort of mean free, the sort of intermolecular collisions or microscopic scales in the problem. So let's say we have some fluid and the temperature varies on some scales L, and L is much, much bigger than the mean free path. So this is what we would use in kinetic theory to derive fluid dynamics. And the theory is described in terms of currents, which are conserved. And this is the only dynamical content of fluid dynamics. Of course, saying that you just have a bunch of conserved currents is not sufficient. I need to tell you what these conserved currents are expressed in terms of the variables of fluid dynamics and what the constitutive relations we have. So let's see what we can write down. So in equilibrium, so global thermal equilibrium, is characterized by some state variables, so it could be characterized by some temperature, some chemical potential, etc., and also by a choice of inertial effect, some static frame which tells us what our choice of stationary time coordinate is. And in fluid dynamics, it's these variables that get promoted from being sort of constant everywhere in space and time to locally varying functions on the fluid domain. So in particular, when you have local equilibrium, we have. Etc. And then, so these are our dynamical fields, and the stress tensor and the current are expressed in terms of these dynamical variables. So if you were to write down an ideal fluid, you just look at the local energy density and pressure, which are built out of the fluid dynamics, the local temperature, and the currents likewise will be determined in terms of local charge density plus corrections. And all I've written here so far is the piece that's the ideal fluid piece, and there will be corrections coming from the fact that once I depart from global equilibrium and allow for local, only local equilibrium, these guys should be corrected order by order in a derivative expansion, and so there will be pieces here which I'm just going to call for now the dissipative parts, because they're going to correspond to dissipation in fluid dynamics. Okay. So everything here is so far specified in terms of the thermodynamic state variables. To finish the problem, I need to tell you what the dissipative pieces in the stress tensor, the higher order terms in the stress tensor, how are they determined in terms of the state variables, and what are the parameters expressing the fluid dynamics. Okay. But this is not enough. Fluid dynamics has one more, an autonomous theory of fluid dynamics also has one more piece of data, which is the entropy current. And this entropy current is constrained to satisfy a second law. In particular, its divergence has to be positive definite. Okay. And again, if you're in global equilibrium, this entropy current is just the entropy density times the velocity field. But then there are corrections which come from the fact that the fluid is no longer an ideal fluid. So as you add dissipative terms, you also have to correct for entropy production. You have to also correct the entropy current. And so at some very basic level, if you were asked, construct a theory of fluid dynamics for me, all you would need to do is, once I tell you what thermal equilibrium means, what my state variables are, you would write down an ideal fluid with those state variables that would correspond to thermal equilibrium. You would then try to classify all possible terms consistent with the symmetries of your problem that can appear in this dissipative part of the stress tensor, that can appear in the dissipative part of the charge current, and so on and so forth, subject to the condition that everything that appears here is consistent with the second law. Okay? So this is a key requirement, that otherwise it's very simple to classify the tensor structures that can appear here. The non-trivial part is ensuring that they continue to satisfy a second law in this context.
So do you have the vector in the currents differing from the vector in the energy momentum tensor? Does that contradict your notion of equilibrium? Supercurrents, for example.
You want a different vector here.
Well, you seem to be insisting on being the same.
Okay, so what I'm talking about here, for most part, is what I would call single component fluids. We can't talk about multi-component fluids. We can't talk about superfluids, for example. I would have another vector, which would correspond to the flow of the superfluid. And so all of these can be generalized. The structure would be the same. There's not much else except that I would write more equations for you.
Right.
Yeah, so if you add more degrees of freedom, so for example, so let me just say what's the story for a second. So if you want to do superfluids, you have a normal component of the current, and you might think there's a component of the current that's sort of the supercurrent part. That really is, you should think of that as the mode that comes from the Goldstone mode that condenses for you to end up in the superfluid phase. Okay, the phase of the condensate has a derivative, and that derivative is your supercurrent, is the vector that sort of procs. And so then, in addition to this, you have one more equation, which some people call the Josephson equation, but the most simple way of thinking about that equation is to think of the curl-free nature, because it's a phase, and that equation supplemented gives you the full dynamics, and then like you will have an expansion for that object as well. So we can write on multi-component fluids, extensions, and so on in the same way. But no matter what you write on here, this is a problem of classifying tensor structures. This is a constraint on the tensor structures that can appear here. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. So let's see. So now I can get myself completely tangled with notation and so on of trying to classify all possible tensor structures. So let me give you a quick feeling for what happens for just uncharged fluids for just energy momentum transport. Okay. Okay. So then I just have global equilibrium characterized by notional temperature and have a velocity field that peaks out some inertial frame. And for uncharged fluids, the tensor structures are very easy because I only need to classify tensor structures that are based on on-shell inequivalent tensors that can contribute to TMU. Okay. By this, what I mean by this is that if I'm trying to treat fluid dynamics as an effective field theory, I'm always free to use lower order equations of motion to eliminate some derivatives in favor of some others. Okay, so this is what I mean by on-shell inequivalent. So I suppose I want to go to first order and write down the tensor structures that can appear in TMU nu dissipated at first order. Then I can use the fact that there are relations between the derivatives of the velocity field and derivatives of pressure and energy density, and therefore derivatives of temperature coming from zeroth order conservation difference equations, just from the relativistic analog of the Euler equation and the continuity equation. So for uncharged fluids, this amounts to looking at tensors built out of derivatives of velocities only. And this we can decompose into a trace piece, a vectorial piece, which is velocity contracted gradient, a shear piece, which is a symmetric traceless two tensor, and an antisymmetric two tensor. So these four objects completely tell you what the gradient of the velocity field is. And it's clear, because the stress tensor is symmetric two tensor, the only things that can appear are either the shear tensor or this expansion piece. Everything else is forbidden by symmetries from appearing in this stress tensor at this order. So we just have two inequivalent tensor structures that we can write down, and fluid dynamics in terms of these for uncharged fluids at first order is very, very simple. This is what I had before, which I will just keep calling the ideal fluid. And then I can add the shear tensor with some coefficient, and I can add the expansion with some coefficient, and then I'm going to add this in the following combination. So I will not get into a subtlety here. I have chosen to work with tensors in a particular frame for fluids where the TMU nu dissipative is orthogonal to U. So this is a choice of fluid frame, so-called Landau frame. We could work in other frames, you would end up having other structures here, but the dynamic of the fluid remains invariant under change of frames.
Change of frame is really a field definition.
It's a field definition, exactly. Okay, so we have two. At this point, we have fixed all the tensor structures, and we have two arbitrary functions of thermodynamic state variables, in this case just function of temperature, which are left undetermined. They can be any function of temperature a priori, subject to a condition that whatever entropy current I write down involving first order invariance satisfies positive divergence condition. And this turns out to be very boring, it doesn't tell us very much, it just tells us that theta and zeta, which I wrote down here, which I'm sure most of you know, are called the shear and bulk viscosity, have to be positive. That's the only condition at this order for any fluid that you can write down from first principles.
What are your assumptions about the fluid?
Okay, so I'm assuming that I had a sensible global equilibrium. Okay. I can sort of do fluctuations of arbitrary amplitude, but fluctuations that respect the fact that they're on scales much larger than microscopic scales, so that I can do some effective field theory, i.e. some kind of gradient expansion, so that I can talk about operators ordered by their gradients. And with those assumptions, this is a unique structure you can write down.
And it's independent of the equation, state of the fluid and...
All of those data are prescribed by thermodynamics. So in particular, P and rho are functions of temperature that would be given to you by the canonical ensemble partition function. Yeah? So the canonical ensemble partition function will determine this part, and then there is this piece, but the canonical ensemble partition function has nothing to say about at this point.
What about the heat flow current, for example?
Yeah, so that's the point I wanted to avoid, so I chose the Landau frame to avoid that. If you don't choose the Landau frame, there is a piece I can add here, which is the acceleration times velocity, which is what you would call the heat flow current, which is relativistic fluid. But I killed that by demanding that I removed it by field definition as Johnson. So we can go to work in a different frame, but there is an explicit thermal conductivity term. But you don't need it.
So somehow U mu nu is not only the velocity of material matter, but also heat.
Yes. So that's Landau's definition of Landau frame. That for relativistic fluids, in the Landau frame, U mu is a time-like component, time-like eigenvector of the energy momentum tensor, whose eigenvalue is energy. So I didn't say one important thing, that U mu was normalized. It was a choice of frame, so I always assume that U mu is one. It's a time-like vector.
So P and rho, therefore, somehow get mixed in with heat?
The gradients, yeah.
They and the gradients. Actually, it depends on what you decide, which current is absolutely conserved, the particle number or the energy.
Right, yeah.
So
yeah.
Now, if you don't have chemical potentials and these two are equivalent, then when you have chemical potentials, they start to be physically.
Yeah. So variable temperature, possibly.
Yes.
But, I mean, we could work a bit harder and work in a frame independent language. It just makes saying things a bit more complicated. But the key point is there's two pieces of data that are not determined. That's all I want you to take away. Okay. Now, we can ask what happens if I go to high order. This is an effective field theory, so I should be able to do this at any order I like. So let's do the second order. And surprisingly, this problem was only fully analyzed 3 months ago. Well, there are elements of this which predate various discussions, but I think the complete solution is only known as of a few months ago. And the point is the following. The second order we can again classify all tensors, and they turn out to be 15 of them. Okay, Okay, so just to give you a sample, you can of course write down gradients of various things I already wrote down. And you can take squares of things I wrote down. Nothing I said so far depends on dimensionality for reasons that I will explain in a moment. I'm in dimensions bigger than fluid dimensions bigger than three. These three. These tensor structures exist.
The factor of the 15 is in the
In low enough dimensions, there might be some constraints, I don't remember, but certainly in four and higher dimensions, I'm sure they're always. Okay, you can write down various other things like acceleration square and so on, but the other things you can write down, because I allowed my fluid to live on a curved manifold, I didn't say this metric was a flat metric. Oops. So there are things involving background curvature, but also a second order in derivatives that can show up at the board.
Is that the part that wasn't done until 3 months ago?
No, well, okay. So tensor structures are classified. I mean, it's not a profound calculation to do. The non-trivial part is this constraint.
Yeah.
So this wasn't done fully.
Even for the flat space.
Even for the flat space.
You'll tell us.
Yeah, I'm just going to tell you the answer. So.
But wouldn't it be fair to say that Lando essentially knew most of the ingredients?
It will turn out in the story that Lando did not know everything. That's not one part. Let's put it this way. ADS-CFT is smarter than Lando.
There might be left outs and downs because he believed the symmetry of the underlying theory.
There were things of that kind that were dropped off. But I also don't think Landau, as far as I know, tried very hard to do second order fluids.
Right, because he had no motivation for doing
it. Okay, so what do you get?
Are you sure it wasn't Lifshitz?
Okay, there's one tensor structure I would like to write down for future use. You can contract the Y tensor, which is the velocity field, which is also second order. Okay. So you might say, okay, fine. So now you have 15 tensor structures. You have to work out what the constraints are, what corrections you can put here, what constraints it imposes here from this second law type constraint. And, well, since at first order you got inequalities, maybe you only get 15 inequalities at second order. This is not true. You get 5 equalities that need to be satisfied at second order among 15 transport conditions. And the obvious question you could ask is, well, did some of you do this calculation 2 years ago where you constructed second order fluids? The answer is yes. We did conformal fluids. We did not do the most general fluid. And this constraint set is empty on conformal fluids. So then, it turns out there are 5 tensor structures, and since I'm familiar with them, I wrote all of them out. There is the gradient of sigma, the sigma squared, omega, and then this wild contracted with velocity. So those are the five kinds of structures that show up, conformal fluids, and their coefficients are unconstrained, apart from some inequalities, positivity inequalities for conformal fluids. However, if you have non-conformal fluid, a general fluid, then you would write down 15 transport coefficients, and you would have five relations between 15 variables.
And how do you define conformal fluids and
conformal fluids? Conformal fluid will be one where the traceless stress tensor vanishes.
That's your only constraint. Are you requiring that the second law is valid for an arbitrary background metric?
Yes.
Is that obviously true? I mean, you could imagine a background metric which was pathological in some way.
So
then you might want the second law to restrict the background metric.
Very good. So, note that what I'm trying to do here is some kind of effective gradient expansion, effective field theory. So I have to insist that whatever background I put my fluid on also respects that gradient expansion. So this R mu nu has to appear in the same order as grad sigma. So these are slowly varying backgrounds of an appropriate kind. So of course, it would be an interesting question to ask what happens if you do something pathological. But I think the answer eventually would be that you're outside the fluid regime because you've tried forcing the fluid in a manner that's inconsistent with the gradient expansion.
So you're saying you get five equalities out of the inequality of the entropy current?
Yeah. How does that work?
Yeah.
So the question is the following. So I'll be schematic. So you write down the entropy current. And you write down all possible tensor structures here, you write down all the tensor structures here. And then you ask, okay, fine. Let me keep correcting this entropy current to higher orders and see if I can ensure positivity at each order by examining the possible tensor structures. If I get positivity at third order, I can sort of complete squares, throw some terms into fourth order. And I can do that as long as at fourth order I have sufficient compensating terms to make those things also well behaved or positive definite. And it turns out if you go through the analysis, sometimes there are just no tensor structure that you can have. And it's sufficient, it turns out, at least for this analysis, it was sufficient to go to fourth order in the entropy current to check and derive these five concepts. So I'm going to give you a slightly different way of seeing this. Seeing this story and an associated conjecture that comes out of it in a moment, which is related to Hartree's point. But yeah, so the equalities come about because of unavailability of tensor structures that can ensure this to happen.
And somehow, no matter which sign you choose to violate this constraint with, it can in some situations lead to a decrease in energy.
Exactly. A better way of saying it is that you can always turn on certain set of flows. You can switch off certain gradients. You can turn on some other gradients. And you can turn on, if these constraints are not satisfied, you can turn on flows which would decrease entropy.
So there's some sort of fundamental difference between first order and second order. Because on the right-hand side, you get certain cross terms with coefficients whose sign you can choose by hand.
Yeah, I mean, the first order is actually, this order is very simple because for an ideal fluid, you can show that this piece by itself has vanishing divergence. So the only interesting thing comes from those etas and zetas. And they turn out to show up with, if I wrote this out, what you would find at first order is that it's eta times sigma squared plus zeta times zeta squared. So that is the answer at first order. There's no zero order contribution. So that's what simplifies the problem. You don't get anything interesting at first order.
But
if
you get something that's like that. A sigma contracted with one of your new structures, and sigma can have either sign, sort of the problem.
Exactly. Gary, you had a question?
Well, at zeroth order, presumably the divergence of that just gives you a formula for the. I mean, you project your equation orthogonal to U, right? And parallel.
Parallel to U, yeah.
And
You have
to use a formula for the ds.
You'll get a formula for ds, but then you can use Gibbs-Duhem or some thermodynamic relation.
Right, but you're also you're still making a few assumptions here, I think, aren't you? I guess that there's nothing else in the zeroth order second law.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's a general question as to what you mean by entropy current outside equilibrium.
No, but even in equilibrium, because at zeroth order, I think, you know, well.
No, in equilibrium, entropy current is entropy times inertial frame. That's a thermodynamic entropy. And I think the only constraint on entropy current, you go to higher orders, you go out of equilibrium.
Well, another question perhaps is at zeroth order, are you assuming that P is a function of rho just?
Yes.
So
I assume that I had.
That's how you could integrate the equation.
Yes. I mean, if I had charges, if I had chemical potentials, then I would have.
Or concerned variables, for example.
I would have more complicated stuff.
Okay.
But something similar would work out.
So it's really just like radiation you're treating, and that's the most typical example.
Yes.
There aren't too many others, I think.
Okay. So. Yeah, so at this point, I want you to remember. And I will give you some implications of this statement or these constraints in justifying my earlier comment about lambda. One consequence of this statement is the following. This says that if I excite certain gradients, and I mean not very precise, and I haven't told you what these constraints are, what tensor structures they constrain, but if I excite the gradients that are constrained in this fashion, then there is no entropy production. And this implies there must be stationary fluid flows. But then, the point is you can do this excitation by coupling the fluid a background matrix. So let me give you a very, very simple example of how this works. Take a fluid. So this is a very ADS here. Take example, you have global ADS. Have this fluid that lives on the boundary, on a sphere across time. You can take that fluid and set it rigidly still. So this turns out to be a stationary solution. It turns out to be a stationary solution that in the bulk corresponds to a rotating black hole solution. But since the fluid is rigidly spinning, it has the velocity field is non-vanishing on the sphere, and in particular has vorticity. It not only has vorticity, it has various tensor structures involving all vorticity contracted arbitrarily many times. But nevertheless, that flow is always stationary. So you can imagine doing this, but you can imagine doing this more generally because now I have a bit of freedom in exciting certain class of shears and vorticities and accelerations to ensure that these constraints are satisfied. So, and since you can do this, it follows that, and since you have stationarity, it follows that certain transport coefficient can be obtained from partition function. Not the thermal partition function in class space, but a thermal partition function on an appropriate background that explicitly forces the fluid to move in a fashion that excites only these constrained transport. So this has been established in a certain class of examples, but I'll show you one example, one case where you can, but I'll outline where this works. But in particular, it has been shown now that these five constraints can be derived from an equilibrium partition function.
So, sorry, does that mean that any fluid which emits an equilibrium partition function satisfies these constraints? Can you say it can be derived from an equilibrium partition function?
So, the general, what has been shown is that the constraints coming from existence of an equilibrium partition function are identical to these constraints. So, what is an example? This is the example that I will describe for you. It's something that came out of playing with charged fluids in ADS, charged black holes in ADS, and this is the topic of fluid dynamics and anomalies. So far I've been talking about systems where I was just looking at just the energy momentum tensor and I had no charges, but now let me generalize my story. Let me imagine that I have one conserved charge. But let me imagine that this conserved, so this conserved charge would correspond to some global symmetry of the field theory. But let me imagine that my field theory has some chiral anomaly, so that this conserved charge actually has a global anomaly. It turns out that I can play this game, and I can sort of break up my higher order pieces in the stress tensor and charge current include what I call anomalous pieces. So these should, in the current, they would be necessarily parity violating terms. I can tell you where they come from in the bulk, but for the moment, this is purely an argument at the level of fluid dynamics. We're not sort of using any ADS CFT. So one such term that can appear here for four-dimensional fluids is an epsilon tensor contracted with U gradient. So this is something you won't write down. This is something Landau-Lipschitz would not write down. The point which was noticed in sort of playing around with ADS-CFT constructions is that the coefficient of this term, the transport coefficient that shows up here, is totally constrained. It's not some arbitrary function like eta which had to satisfy some positivity constraint. It was a number determined by the anomaly of the microscopic theory. And then people gave an argument, starting from the second law, that not only was it consistent for it to be constrained, but it had to be constrained in order for entropy production to fully occur. But you can say something stronger, and what you can say is that the following statement appears to be true. So you have some conserved currents, and you have some anomaly in your field theory. Take the anomaly polynomial. Which is a function of background electromagnetic currents and background curvatures. Okay? So this is something we can write down given the microscopic Lagrangian for the field theory. And this guy, you can take this guy and make the formal replacement of the following. Replace the field strength that shows up in the anomaly polynomial, wherever it shows up, by the chemical potential, and replace all curvature data, in particular replace the first Pontryagin class by the temperature, and replace all higher Pontryagin classes by zero. This is a function I can build. This function is purely a function of thermodynamic state variables. And from this, I can construct an anomalous free energy which is built out of, I won't write out the formula, its heat inverse P is in one derivative of P, but this anomalous free energy completely determines all anomalous transport of this problem. So it's, this is the partition function of the kind I was talking about. This object determines certain class of transport completely. Okay. Now you can generalize this, which is what I was saying earlier, but this is a specific example of this general construction.
So, sorry, all of these five constraints are related to anomalies, or?
No. So this is a different problem. Okay. This is an uncharged fluid, there are no anomalies. I'm saying that the one context that's easy to describe what the partition function is,
Great. Is
this. To get these constraints, what you do, you take a fluid and put it on a curved background, which excites the constrained tensor structures, and just those alone. So think of the case where nothing, think of the rotating fluid case. You excite omega and various powers of omega, just the vorticity.
So what do you mean by exciting those with the metric? I mean, you just put this, the metric is just a sphere across time.
So I need a stationary solution. So in order for that stationary solution to exist, the velocities have to take certain profile, and those profiles in turn tell you what the gradients are to whatever order you're interested in. You have a solution, it's a stationary solution.
I'm just not sure what you meant by the term to excite those gradients with the metric.
In particular, for the sphere, what I want to say is that the flow does not turn on shear, it only turns on vorticity. If it turned on shear, then it would have entropy production. It only turns on vorticity.
I see. You say given four velocity, or given the velocity field of the curve of the fluid and the metric, it makes the difference.
Yeah. Okay. So those are.
Yes. So do I ask about if you now have some rotating black hole in ADS?
Yeah.
You can compute T mu nu and make an expansion and read off. You get some vorticity terms, if that's what you're saying, and you can read off the transport code.
I claim this if all the statements that have been made so far are consistent with that statement, yes. No one has done that exercise yet.
I should also say.
Okay, so that's the story as far as fluid dynamics is concerned. I now want to do the second part of relating this to the gravitational setup, and I can be reasonably quick about this. So, why do we want to talk about fluid and gravity? And this observation comes from observation that gravitational systems might have anything, something to do with fluid dynamics, comes from study of linear fluctuations. Of black holes, which are given in terms of quasi-normal modes. And a typical quasi-normal mode spectrum for a class of black holes, either planar black holes in ADS or black brains, as we shall see later, is of the following kind. So I'm being schematic, but the general picture that I know of is the following. That typically, in this class of black holes, you have what I would call a light quasi-normal mode. That is a quasi-normal mode in the system whose frequency goes to zero as momentum goes to zero with some power. So these are light excitations in this black hole background, and the black hole background corresponds to global equilibrium. So we have some light excitations in the background, and actually there's something interesting here which I'll just mention in passing, that typically the spacing, if you have systems with multiple scales, in particular if you have a system with a thermal scale and a chemical potential scale, the spacing of the poles on the axis always seems to be given by the temperature, whereas the spacing of the poles off the axis is given by the chemical potential. So, because it's a light quasi-normal mode, if you sort of excite this black hole and watch it relax, at 8 times, it's these quasi-normal modes that dominate that relaxation. They tell you that at 8 times, the system sort of enters some kind of regime dominated by this mode, and these dispersions have been observed before to be of the hydrodynamic form. In particular, you have dispersions that are linear, plus corrections, and you have dispersions that are quadratic with corrections, which we identify as a sound mode and the diffusion mode of the corresponding fluid. But these are, of course, just linear dispersion modes. You can ask, what happens if I don't study linear fluctuations in the black hole background, but the full set of nonlinear fluctuations about this equilibrium? And the answer is yes, you can, provided you sort of don't excite other quasi-normal modes. In other words, if you can somehow zoom in to the dynamics of just this isolated one single quasi-normal mode, or family of quasi-normal modes, if you have more than one, then you should be able to write down a collective theory of those quasi-normal modes, and that collective theory should be in the boundary, no different from hydrodynamics. So the claim is that collective theory of light quasi-normal modes And this statement seems to be true, it's true by construction in AES space times, but it also seems to be true in asymptotically flat space times, in Rindler geometry, and so on and so forth. Which was part of the reason for my inclusion earlier that this is a part of a much bigger story involving black holes. And the picture is very simple. It literally transports the picture we had of these little domains of fluid into a gravitational context by doing a suitable approximation. So what do we do? So let's imagine that global equilibrium in...
Excuse me, Mukund?
Yeah?
Did you just say that if you study quasi-normal modes of a Rindler horizon, you get the same picture?
Yes. I should qualify that by saying that if you allow Rindler quasi-normal modes with usual asymptotic flat region, there are no quasi-normal modes. Rindler space doesn't have quasi-normal modes. If I put some cutoff, which I will do later, put a Dirichlet wall somewhere, then there are quasi-normal modes. And in fact, this mode doesn't exist there, this mode does. So that will be important when we talk about the membrane paradigm. So global equilibrium is given by a stationary black hole solution. All you want to do, so let's say this has some matrix, and for simplicity, let me assume that it depends on one variable which I'll call R. So in AES, this will be the radial variable that sort of goes away from the boundary. What you can do is on the boundary, so this is some solution that looks like this. And what you can do on the boundary is you can sort of allow deviations from equilibrium suitably of this fluid dynamical form so that they are sort of suitably long wavelength. My formula is gone now. But so in some domain, I have equilibrium at some fixed temperature and with a fixed charge of inertial frame. In the neighboring domain, there is a slightly different temperature and slightly different inertial frame and so on. And the construction simply says that, well, just patch together different black hole geometries along these ingoing null directions. And this patchwork quilt of black hole space times is a gravitational analog of fluid dynamics. Okay. And that's the construction. That's all there is to the construction. I can spell out a bit more in words if people want what exactly we do. But basically, this guy, I shouldn't say GMU, this is some bulk matrix, GAB. This is some determined in terms of some parameters. Here, which characterize equilibrium, and you, as in fluid dynamics, just promote these parameters to functions that vary along these directions and leave them arbitrary to be determined in this other direction. And let's call this G0. G0 doesn't solve any equations unless U, mu, and T's are constants, in which case it was a stationary solution. But I can mock up the fact that it doesn't solve the equations order by order in a perturbation expansion. And the perturbation expansion is simply the strength of gradients. In this formula. So it's sort of clear what happens. What happens is that you take this and stick this into your bulk equation of the motion. Well, whatever piece involving one gradient of these guys is not solved, it sources G1. So you can solve for G1 in terms of some inhomogeneous equation. And once you solve for G1, you can go away, solve for G2, and so on and so forth. It's a very algorithmic construction that you can carry out arbitrary orders. We got tired after 2 and stopped it. And once I've said it this way, there's nothing specific about asymptotically ADS spacetimes, about Schwarzschild ADS black holes. As long as you have this hierarchy and you have the small expansion parameter, you should be able to do this for any black hole in any space. Okay? So that's the general story. And our original study involved constructing this for ADS Schwarzschild black holes. People have then generalized this to charged black holes in ADS, which was the genesis for this story, to non-conformal grains, understanding how various things work away from conformal invariants, and sort of then do, what else can you do? You can force the fluid, you can do superfluids, as Gary was asking earlier, in the context where of these condensates involving charged scalar fields. You have to keep additional modes, you have to in particular keep the phase of the scalar, and carry out the same procedure. So, if people are happy about this, I'll then move on to talking about the membrane paradigm and in some short time to wrap up soon. So the picture, as I was here, involved study of dynamics, at least as far as I started presenting, in terms of asymptotically ADS spacetimes, and that's sort of already presaged by my picture. But you don't have to do things this way. And suppose you are interested in questions like membrane paradigm, you might not want to ask what the fluid is doing here on the boundary of ADS spacetime, but rather on some surface that's time-like and close to the boundary, close to the horizon. There's some kind of stretched horizon that you have. So of course, the answer is, well, you tell me what boundary conditions you want to impose on the surface, and then I can go away, implement the same exercise, provided I still have small gradients in this construction. But, so it therefore follows automatically, without doing a calculation, that whatever you want to call a membrane paradigm is subsumed in the boundary dynamics. But we can be more specific about this. We can try to ask, in what sense can I get dynamics on this membrane in terms of the boundary CFT dynamics. So that's the part I want to explain. And the point is very, very simple. So let's say, let me draw a slightly different picture. I have the boundary of ADS. I have some horizon. It's a cot r plus. And I want to talk about fluids on some surface, which is time-like, some surface sigma, which is somewhere in the box. Okay. For the moment, I've drawn it somewhere distinct from the horizon, but I might, at the end of the day, be interested in the region where I push the surface arbitrarily close to the horizon. And I want to ask, okay, let me prescribe some metric on the surface and solve Einstein's equations around global equilibrium on the surface with this prescribed metric. Okay? So that will give me some solution that should be valid in this region. And if I get lucky, I should be able to sort of also ask how to extend that solution all the way to the ADS boundary. And I should be able to ask, once I've fixed the metric and the state, solved the problem, extracted the stress tensor on this surface, how is that related to the boundary metric and the boundary system? So in general, the problem is very simple. I want to specify Dirichlet boundary conditions here for the metric and build up the response on the stress tensor, and then ask, what does specification of Dirichlet boundary conditions for the metric, for the bulk metric on the surface, mean in terms of boundary conditions at ADS boundary? It's clear that whatever this boundary condition is, it involves doing something funny involving both the boundary metric and the boundary stress tensor and the boundary ADS, because I have to tune them in concert so as to attain an appropriate boundary condition for just the metric on the surface. So I don't know how to solve this problem in general, but it turns out that in this long wavelength fluid regime, because these tubes, when I'm in my patchwork picture, simply go through these surfaces, I can just pull things back and ask what happens in this context. And so, or better yet, what I should say is that we can solve for the bulk geometry for arbitrary slowly varying boundary metrics and read out the boundary stress sensor. And in the extended family of solutions, I can choose one where my surface at some fixed radius has a desired metric. I can tune things so that it works. So I can write down a map from this data to the boundary data. What should be clear is that whatever the map is, the two stress tensors, both on the boundary and on this hypersurface, have to be conserved, because this boundary stress sensor is conserved by a consequence of Einstein constraint equations. This is just a Brown-York stress tensor corrected. Likewise, this is an appropriate Brown-York stress tensor corrected on this hypersurface, so that also must be conserved. But either way, you can just think of this as the constraint equations on different time-like hypersurfaces. Okay, so.
Does this melting preserve trace distance as well?
Very good question. It doesn't, and it shouldn't, because I put in a scale here, which is the radial location of this object. Okay. So I had a boundary stress tensor which in ADS was traceless and conserved. I have a stress tensor here which is not traceless but conserved. There's a nice formula for the trace, but I won't tell you what it is. This stress tensor is characterized by some transport coefficients. And this stress tensor is characterized by some transport coefficients. So it turns out that because of tracelessness of the boundary stress tensor, zeta is 0. And eta is given by its famous value. What's funny and not at all obvious but it just popped from a calculation, means that zeta hat is zero, when it didn't have any life to be, because the stress center is not traceless, and eta hat
This is for any choice of G hat?
Or this is for any choice of G hat.
Is it still zero?
Sorry?
Okay, so I thought.
Zeta hat still says zero.
But it's not traceless.
The stress center is not traceless. In particular, okay, so I'll tell you what happened in a moment. So here, there's a conformal equation of state. Here there is no longer a conformal equation state. The equation of state knows about this scale. So energy and pressure are not given by the asymptotic values, they're given by some free scale values. That's what contributes to the trace. But at first order, it turned out that the first order transport is unaffected. I don't know what happens for second order.
If you have a stationary solution in the bulk, you can move the boundary in without screwing up the interior solution.
But that would not be true at zero order. That would just involve rescaling. That's why energies and pressures are given by some thermodynamics is easily determined. This is first order. You see, now I have gradients.
Yeah.
The gradients in all directions. So it's no longer
stationary.
There are no symmetries of this order. There's nothing that tells me that this should be true. There's an argument for this that extends what Nabil and Hong Liu gave, which makes it clear that eta should not be denormalized. But I don't have a corresponding argument for Boltzmann's cause. But let's see. The equation of state involving what I call rho hat and p hat is such that you can plot one object, which is the speed of sound, this is a conformal value. So it starts out at its conformal value, and diverges as I go to the horizon, crossing 1 at some random position in space, which goes back to my earlier statement that if you go to the Rindler region, I don't have a propagating sound mode. Okay, so this is the statement about the dispersions that you have. So you have omega goes by CS hat k plus corrections. There's a diffusive mode that survives, and that diffusive mode is simply given by eta or eta hat, and that diffusion constant is appropriately rescaled as you go from infinity. Because the speed of sound is going to infinity near the horizon, what's happening to the fluid is that the fluid is essentially getting incompressible. And the equations you get on this hypersurface are those of incompressible Navier-Stokes equations, as other people have discussed.
Is the fluid also becoming non-relativistic?
The fluid is becoming incompressible. I don't think incompressibility is consistent with relativistic fluids. The fluid is becoming non-relativistic.
Is that the speed of sound that's going?
Because of speed of sound.
This critical radius, where the speed of sound is 1, is there any nice interpretation or value?
I don't know, but it's something has to go from whatever, 1 over d minus 1 infinity, it goes through at some t dependent position.
Okay.
There's nothing special about it. So this is the story as far as the membrane paradigm is concerned. In the last 5 more minutes, I will tell you how this all fits into black holes and stuff. Okay, so now there's a sort of separate story that if people want a more detailed exposition should ask Niels. Involves studying black brains, but now neutral black brains or charged black brains in asymptotically flushed. So far all this discussion was in area space-time. I either had area space-time with the full boundary or some random Dirichlet wall that I chucked in. And now you can ask what happens for black brains. In asymptotically flushed. So again, you have a brain, so you can sort of look at fluctuations along the world volume, and again do this gradient expansion. And nothing in the story dependent on the asymptotics, on the details, only place where asymptotics will come in is that you'll only keep more that are suitably normalizable for that corresponding asymptotics. And here, what you find is you find fluid dynamics. Except that before I even did this, someone should have objected, saying, here I started in ADS black. ADS black holes have a nice property that when they're very big, I have nice thermodynamics. So it makes sense to do hydrodynamics about a good thermodynamic partition function. Black brains in asymptotically flat space-time, among other things, have negative specific heat. So the thermodynamic system here is not well behaved. So what am I doing with fluctuations? And so the formal procedure gets carried through, but I want to emphasize that this has some interesting implication. So what you'll find here is that the pressure is negative, and the energy density is positive. So a relic of the fact that these guys didn't have good thermodynamics is the fact that the speed of sound is negative. So this means the system has a tachyon, and this tachyon actually has an incarnation that we have seen a long time ago. We know that black brains, if you don't add charges to them, have Gregory Laplace instabilities. These are long wavelength instabilities, so in particular you should be able to see them in hydrodynamics. And this is a signal of the Gregory Laplace instability at the level of hydrodynamics. So let me just now plot the imaginary part of the frequency for the linearly dispersing mode as a function of momentum along the brain. I find a dispersion curve that starts out linearly like this with the speed of sound set by purely this thermodynamics. What's actually amusing is that if you carry this exercise out and find correct for the stress tensor at first order, you can actually try to complete this curve and you find this curve looks like this. Now, this curve has been seen before. This is the Gregory Laplace curve. And the hydrodynamic approximation, so what was guaranteed is some domain around here. Okay, that's the long wavelength regime. That's where hydrodynamics is supposed to run. What's funny in this problem is that if you go to sufficiently large brains in sufficiently high code, of sufficiently high codimension, the space-time has many, is of sufficiently high dimension, then this hydrodynamic approximation to this curve agrees on the nose with the explicit Gregory Laplace. So the example that people they plot is look for brains of three brains, for example, in 100 dimensions, and the data points that you'll get like precisely on this curve that you get from hydrodynamics.
Is it understood why increasing the number of dimensions helps the agreement?
So my intuition is that some kind of mean field theory kicks in. But I don't have any more precise statement to make at this point. And now finally, I can stop by overviewing why I think all of this, where all of this fits. The point is, we should have known this, I would say, 15 years ago. 15 years ago, we were trying to compute various things by throwing things at deep rates and seeing what happens. So now imagine doing a problem I outlined there for the full non-extremal D3 brain. As a specific example I have in mind, it is some horizon somewhere down the throat. And the point is, you can sort of be out here, do this long wavelength approximation, and you get black holes. You can be down here in the throat and do the long wavelength approximation, you will get fluid gravity, or fluid gravity as we know in ADS CFT. You can be arbitrarily close to the horizon and do the long wavelength approximation, and you'll get membrane paradigm as I described in terms of these Navier-Stokes equations. But the superstructure is simply the fact that brains, black brains, simply want to be fluids when they have extended images. And you can see this working implicitly in this context, and see how you interpolate between the what might be a gridly Laplace unstable brain to the depth, to the near extremal region, where you get a conformal fluid, to the ultra near horizon fluid. That.
We had a lot of questions already, so we should break for tea. Sorry, Alejandra.
No, I can ask them later.
This is a very special. Thank you.